out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 12th of July, 2018, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. You may have noticed that we swapped around Dr. Johnson's day this week. He was on the Daily Nationalist yesterday, so you've just got a solo episode from me today. And we're not going to look at current news. We are actually going to look at a part of the British Empire. We talked a bit about the British Empire on Monday with Eddie Morrison, with the League of Empire Loyalists. And we've also spoken a little bit about what happened in India with Dennis Wise on Truthful Out Radio. And I pointed out at the time when we were talking about India that the British people over there may well have had reason to be worried that the Indians would mutiny and cause a massacre, which, you know, it doesn't excuse the British behaviour over there, but it does explain why they were wary of Indians and why they shot a lot of unarmed Indians. And what we're going to look at today is the reason why the British behaved the way they did in India. We're going to look at the British Empire from a different viewpoint than the one that is taught in schools. And we're actually going to get this again from March of the Titans by Arthur Kemp. And we have criticised this book before because of his views on Christianity and his rather slack research on Christianity. But I think this bit on India, I think, is particularly good. So give him full marks for this. Anyway, quoting from the book. Thousands of British men and women went to India, not to establish permanent settlements, but to run the Raj, or empire in India, and to drag India into the modern technological age. As a result, in a very short space of time, India was completely transformed. The white rulers built railway lines, telegraph wires, bridges, roads, irrigation systems, postal services, the first Indian schools, and almost all the essential infrastructure on the subcontinent. The British also transformed India on a social level. The introduction of a Western-style police force and judicial system helped stamp out the practice of sooty, in which widows were burned alive on the funeral pyres of their deceased husbands, the murder of female children, and slavery, which was rampant in certain parts of India. And I'll say that today, slavery is rampant in Britain among the non-whites, and the mutilation of female children we now have in Britain, thanks to importing the Third World over here. But that's another story. Continuing. In addition, the British authorities also managed to break the centuries-old criminal mafia in India, called the Thuggies. These criminals had plagued Indian society with their murderous activities, and it was only through the introduction of modern policing methods by Superintendent William Sleeman that it was brought to a halt. The English word thug is derived from this time. The British, like the Romans before them, used natives in their armed forces. And that's something that we are still doing today. Even in Britain, we have an army that is filled with non-whites, and they're even advertising for more non-whites. And they're really just setting up a great tragedy by doing that. As we will see here, a great massacre ensued after they did this and trusted these non-whites. Indian volunteers in the British-run army were known as sepoys, and they were divided into three major groups: the Bengal Army, stationed in Delhi, the Bombay Army, and the Madras Army, the last two stationed in the towns bearing their names. By 1857, the sepoys in the Bengal Army numbered 150,000. At that stage, there were around 23,000 white British troops in India, scattered all over the subcontinent. I wonder how many Muslims we currently have in the British Army. I mean, they could just rise up at any time, really, couldn't they? In 1845, Sikhs in the Punjab attacked isolated British outposts and inflicted heavy casualties before they were driven off. 2 years later, Sikhs attacked British outposts at Chilianwala. A large number of sepoys and white officers were killed in the attacks, but the Sikhs were decisively beaten by 1849. In January 1857, a rumour spread through the sepoys in the Bengal army that new ammunition issued to them had been packed in grease, which had been derived from cattle and pigs. Standard operating procedure at the time was for the soldiers to tear open these packs in order to access the ammunition. Under combat conditions, the soldiers had been taught to tear open the packs with their teeth. This contravened the religious dictates of Hindus and Muslims alike, to whom cattle and pigs were sacred and not to be eaten. That's the cattle to the Hindus and the pigs to the Muslims. In May 1857, 85 sepoys were placed under arrest by their white officers for refusing to open their ammunition packs. This act of defiance soon spread throughout almost the entire Bengal army. Soon, the British officers had a racial rebellion on their hands, made more serious by the fact that, for once, the Indians were armed with the latest weaponry, including cannons, which they had seized from their barracks. The uprising became known as the Devil's Wind, or the Indian Mutiny, of 1857. Thousands of sepoys launched an attack on the British Army outposts in Delhi and killed hundreds of white soldiers, their wives and children, often with the active assistance of formerly loyal Indian servants. Within a day, the entire city was in sepoy hands. British soldiers and their families who survived the initial onslaught took refuge in a number of fortified emplacements around Delhi. One British detachment managed to take control of the main army's ammunition dump inside the city with the intention of keeping it out of the rebels' hands. The sepoys then launched a determined assault on the armory, and as it was about to fall, the British defenders blew up the ammunition stack. Although the massive blast was heard 100 miles away and hundreds of sepoys were killed, the British defenders only lost 3 men in the engagement, and the rest managed to escape in the resultant confusion to a British-held fort to the north of the city. Anti-white massacres and riots spread throughout north-central India over the following weeks, with the isolated white detachments being slaughtered in an uncompromising racial war. One of the most notable of these massacres took place in the tiny kingdom of Jhansi in June 1857. Jhansi had been annexed by the British 4 years earlier when the local king had died, and now his widow took her revenge. All the whites in the kingdom were stabbed and clubbed to death, the women being left for last so that they were forced to watch their men and children being killed. The sepoy rebellion also spread to Kanpur and Lucknow, both in the state of Oudh. In Kanpur, some 1,000 white British soldiers, along with their wives and children, took refuge from the non-white mobs in a fortified magazine in the city near the Ganges River. There they bedded down in the hope of a relief column, which they had been promised from other British outposts. The sepoys laid siege to the Kanpur magazine for 20 days. When their water ran out, the defenders were forced to surrender on June 25, 1857. The survivors, now numbering 400, were promised safe conduct out of the city. They were taken to the Ganges, where a number of boats had been drawn up to carry them away. It was, however, a ruse. As soon as they reached the river, the sepoys opened fire, and 200 were killed, leaving only 3 men, 73 women, and 124 children alive. The survivors were taken prisoner by the sepoys and locked up in a part of the emplacement buildings known as the Bibigar. By this time it was clear that the original excuse for the uprising, the alleged animal grease on the ammunition packs, no longer mattered to the sepoys, as they willingly used the bullets to kill as many British people as possible. So we have a pretend reason for the uprising there, but the real reason is just because they wanted to kill white British people. It's the same as this pretend reason of racism that gets alleged at white people as an excuse so that non-whites can attack them. It's exactly the same thing, only what we've got here is a trained army trained by the British then rising up and attacking the British and their children here. Continuing. On July 15th, 1857, the three surviving white men were dragged out of the Bibigar and shot before a large crowd of Indians who had clambered onto the walls of the compound. The Indians then returned for the women, but even though many were desperately sick with disease, they put up a fierce struggle. An eyewitness account made during the course of a later British investigation into the events at the Bibigar relates what happened next. Quote, "The double doors at the end of the courtyard were flung open again, and the ladies ordered out, but they refused to move and tightened their grips on the veranda pillars and on each other's arms and waists, trying to keep from crushing their weeping children underfoot. The sepoys declared it impossible to separate them or drag them out of the building and backed out of the yard. Someone suggested that they secure the doors from the inside, and several women ran over and, tearing strips of cloth from their gowns, frantically bound the door handles together. A few ladies raised their quaking voices in a hymn. Now, the Jemadar, the senior Indian officer, ordered his men to stand outside the doors and windows on one side. At a signal from the Jemadar, his men thrust the barrels of their muskets through the window shutters along the wall. With a great cry, the women and children tried to move across the courtyard to the far veranda and seek cover behind the pillars and the tree, but there was hardly any room. The courtyard was only 16 feet wide, the veranda 5 feet, and the long room 10 feet, so most managed only to compress themselves up towards the opposite veranda, while the remainder, including some of the sick and orphaned children, crouched helplessly on the courtyard ground. 20 sepoys aimed their muskets into this wave of bodies and opened fire at point-blank range. The first volley paired some of the foremost layer of women and children away, and may have wounded a few beyond. The sepoys backed away from the smoking window, and a second squad moved in to take their places. By now, many of the survivors of the two volleys had probably found cover in the sleeping rooms beyond the pillars. A little before sunset, Sarvar Khan, one of the rebels, appeared, trailing 4 companions, each with a scimitar in his hand. 2 of his recruits were aproned Muslim butchers, both tall, one dark, pockmarked and stout. The other 2 appeared to be of low caste. As they approached, the onlookers resumed their places along the compound wall. Inside, some of the women dragged the dead to one side and tried to tend to the wounded. A few soldiers' wives and daughters were determined to fight. Now they could hear the bolt sliding back. Someone heaved against the doors, and the cloth strips between the handles began to strain and break. The doors burst open and slapped against the walls. Stepping out from under the dark shadow of the mulzuri tree, the Baramin Sahib, the senior white woman, opened her mouth to speak. Sarvar Khan felled her with one stroke. Fearful shrieks rose from the courtyard. Closing the doors behind them, the 5 men fanned out and worked their way forwards, slashing at the straggling wounded crawling across the floor. From behind a pillar, Mrs. Jacoby suddenly lunged forward and knocked one of them down with one blow. But his comrades came to his rescue. First, they hung her daughter Lucy on a hook by her chin, and then silenced her mother by cutting her throat. They knew that stabbing was inefficient, that hacking at their victims' necks would be the quickest way of accomplishing their mission. If the ladies protected their necks with their arms, then their arms would simply be severed as well. The effect was the same. They would bleed to death, slashing right and left at all who were standing, chopping downwards at the fallen with their heavy blades. The 5 proceeded methodically, spreading a pool of blood. Others tried to dodge the men's swords by ducking into the doorways and around the pillars, and so often did Sarvar Khan strike the walls that he broke 2 swords and twice emerged to fetch new weapons from his fellows. Though the shutters of the doors and windows remained open, none of the women or children tried to escape out of the building, surrounded as it was by sepoys and Indian onlookers. The few defiant boys were cut down quickly, as was every child who tried to make a run for it through the phalanx of swordsmen. Mothers kept pulling their children close to them and pushing them back into the corners of the building, and in the sweltering heat and the crush of bodies, children suffocated to death under their dying mothers' skirts. It took something less than an hour for the chorus of wailing to die away to a few individual voices, and then even these were stilled. Mrs. Probert may have died in a counterattack, for her body, like Mrs. Jacoby's, was left that evening, tied to a pillar. Close quote. By the morning of July 16, 1857, news of the previous day's massacre had spread through the entire city of Cawnpore, and thousands of Indians assembled to view the carnage. The eyewitness account continues. Quote, around 8 in the morning, the crowd parted to make way for a burial party of scavengers. By now, they were masters at this sort of thing. They had already amassed a small fortune from the plunder and disposal of English bodies at Shatti Chowra and Shivada House, where the white men of Cawnpore had been executed. But the mission today was unusual. The bodies were not to be dumped into the Ganges this time, but down an irrigation well some 40 feet south of the Bibigar. The cavity of the well was 9 foot wide and 50 foot deep. 3 steps led up to the rim. The veteran scavengers set to work, dragging the uppermost bodies out. But suddenly, stepping into one of the sleeping chambers, they made an alarming discovery. 3 or 4 of the ladies, and perhaps as many children, sitting huddled in the shadows, still alive after a night of lying on the floor, saturated with the blood of their late friends and companions, and surrounded by their mangled bodies. The burial squad backed away, and hurried off to the old Cawnpore Hotel, the rebel headquarters, for further instruction. When they returned, 2 of the women rushed past, stumbling over the low sill of a side window, and running into the yard. They lunged straight to the lip of the well, and jumped in, one after the other, falling some 50 feet to the bottom. The children, all aged between 5 and 6 years, followed the women out into the courtyard, but only ran around the well. Where else could they go? At first they were chased, but the shrieking children eluded their captors. They decided to let the children run themselves out while they went about their business. They brought out the bodies of the dead and the near dead, grabbing many of them by the hair and dragging them through the grass. Those whose clothes were worth taking were stripped before they were rolled over the rim of the well. Several severely wounded women were still breathing when they were dragged out. 3 could even speak. As the burial party continued to drag corpse after corpse through the bloody grass and dump them into the depths of the well, it became obvious that at this rate, not all the dead were going to fit in. So they went to work, severing with their swords the stiffening limbs of the dead and tucking them into the interstices of the half-choked well. At last came the time to dispose of the children, who kept running around until at last they were caught and flung alive into the well. Close quote. The white garrison at Lucknow were also besieged, but having taken great care in the drawing up of their provisions, were able to hold out for 4 months until they were relieved by a British force from the south. The British authorities had, in the interim, regrouped and drawn together a small but powerful column which raced north to relieve what they thought were the various encampments still holding out. Lucknow was relieved to much joy, but what they found at Cawnpore caused their hardest soldiers to break down and weep, particularly when messages scrawled in blood were found on the walls of the Bibigar, scribbled by the dying victims as last messages to their loved ones. The massacre at the Bibigar turned British public opinion in Britain firmly against the rebellion, and reinforcements were sent to India, which crushed it completely. By June 1858, the last of the sepoy rebels had been captured. Many were shot or hanged, but the leaders were publicly executed by being strapped to the barrels of cannons and blown to pieces. The British covered up the well at Bibigar and erected a memorial on the spot. This memorial remained located over the well until Indian independence in 1947, when it was moved to the gardens of the Kanpur Memorial Church in Kanpur. The major result of the Sepoy Mutiny was that the British Parliament enacted legislation termed the 1858 Act for the Better Government of India, which transferred the administration of India from the East India Company to the British government. This constitutional shift was formalised in 1876 when the British Queen Victoria was proclaimed Empress of India, though what the Indians thought of this was never recorded. Despite the suppression of the 1857 rebellion, Indian resistance to British rule continued in fits and starts. By the end of the 19th century, Indian nationalists had resorted to renewed armed attacks on whites in India as a means of exerting political pressure on the British to leave. The British authorities reacted with a series of repressive laws, which served only to alienate even more Indians. In 1909, the British tried to alleviate the growing demands for independence with constitutional reform, a move which only served to inflame demands for the end to all colonial rule. Indian unrest continued, and by 1919, waves of riots and disturbances reached such a level that the British authorities suspended all civil rights in a number of areas through a series of laws known as the Rowlatt Acts. A large protest by Indians turned violent in Amritsar, Punjab, in April 1919, and a local military unit, under the command of British officers, opened fire on the crowd. Over 400 casualties were inflicted, and the Amritsar massacre became a rallying point for the Indian nationalist movement against British rule. And that Amritsar massacre is what we were discussing on Truthful Out Radio. And the point of it was how bad it was that these British were firing on unarmed Indians. But I think we can see from the way that the Indians treated the British when they rebelled why this British military unit would have been concerned at this big gathering of so-called unarmed Indians, and also why the British government didn't punish the guy for shooting them. And it could very easily have turned into another one of these uprisings, like this Sepoy uprising. And again, this was all brought about by having non-white troops in the army. Not just having white British troops, but having brown people and teaching them how to use weapons, which they obviously they're just waiting for an instance when they get a chance to use those weapons against us. Well, finally, increasing unrest between Muslims and Hindus added further fuel to the fire, and Britain eventually granted India complete independence in 1947, after it was split into Hindu and Muslim states. In this way, Pakistan and Bangladesh were split from India, with the former two states being Muslim-dominated. Large numbers of nationals from all three of these countries have subsequently emigrated to Europe, North America and Australia, with disastrous consequences. And it's the consequences of that we are seeing now. And also, when the British left India and Pakistan and Bangladesh were split from the country, it was instantly a huge massacre, with millions of Hindus were killed by the Muslims. It was only the British being there that was keeping law and order and preventing them from massacring one another. I mean, that's what they do when they don't have the British there. We see exactly the same thing happening in Africa, out in the Congo right now. Horrific things are going on because there's no white man there. When there's no white man there, these non-whites will just flee to white countries because they know that if they stay in their own countries, they run the high risk of being shot, killed, butchered, eaten, raped. And we're bringing all that into Europe right now by importing these creatures into our countries, especially these ones that are claiming to be refugees. And the ones claiming to be refugees, if they are refugees, if they have been in a war zone, that's the sort of thing they're used to seeing every day. They're going to think nothing of killing somebody who insults their honour. They're going to think nothing of seeing an attractive woman and raping them. That's what they've been used to doing in their own countries. How can anyone in a sound mind think that it's a good idea to bring this kind of a threat into our white countries that were the envy of the world when they were white? They were safe. Law and order, the forces of law and order used to rule in Britain before the non-white invasion. Anyway, that's it for today's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory. We'll be right back.